Felt Radio is brought to you by BoonRidge.com, the home of adventure.
With a plan to expand my vision. Yeah, it's either this or it's prison. I'm trying to be free and expand my wisdom. I gotta tell my story. I did it for the journey, the glory. Many men tried way before me. I had to do it bigger because I had to make history.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting in Port Townsend, Washington. Port Townsend, Washington is one of the last wooden boat working places in the entire country. You find a couple of places out east in Maine that still build wooden boats. But Port Townsend is really unique within the United States as wooden boats and building out of wood is still hugely popular. Had a giant resurgency here. And so I came out here to do some talks at the Wooden Boat Festival. It's a three-day festival, and I did three talks, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it went really, really well. They're really good to me out here. I mean, they're really, really good to me. The audiences are always great. I did a talk about the trip around the Americas and, like, brought the freaking house down. You know, they're just such a lively audience, you know, and I've done that talk a couple hundred times now, but I came out here a few years ago to do a talk at the symposium, too, and it was the same thing. I mean, it's just a great crowd. It's such the people out here are just so nice. People in Northwest, in this part, I mean, I can't speak for, like, the interior of Washington State, but the people along the coast, especially in Port Townsend, man, I could easily move to this town. I would love to live here. You know, the problem is, it's just there's not that there's not a lot here, but it doesn't really compare well to Annapolis when it comes to trying to run an organization and all the rest. I mean, Annapolis, there's a lot more money there. There's a lot more boats there. You're right by Washington, D.C., where there's a lot of headquarters for major foundations. I have the ability to drive a half hour, and I can be at the headquarters of a major organization, you know, a major foundation, and I can actually meet with the people who run the thing. You can't do that if you're out here, at least not as easily. But everybody's just so friendly. I even got pulled over. I was driving here, and I got pulled over for going, I don't know, whatever, 7 miles an hour over the speed limit at like 1 a.m. When I first got here. It's about a 2.5 hour drive from Seattle. So you fly into Seattle, about 2.5 hour drive. Even the cop that pulled me over was super nice. You know, I had like big giant smile and almost apologized for pulling me over. And, and shooting the shit with me. And it's just like, geez, everybody is so friendly. It's kind of strange, but Port Townsend, Washington, and Washington State in particular, has a lot in common with Maine. You know, the people in Maine are also incredibly friendly and incredibly nice. I would rather live here, though. The weather here in the wintertime isn't too bad. I just like the West Coast mentality, man. I struggled with Annapolis. You know, when I first came to Annapolis out of Ohio, it was just really hard. Like, it was hard to fit in. I don't know. The Midwest mentality. You know, it's like I come from places where there's a lot of, well, there was a lot of factories and factory workers, and all the factories got shut down. And I don't know, it's just a different sort of vibe there than, you know, Annapolis is it's much more highly, you know, tightly bound, and people have their nose in the air a little more. It's just that East Coast mentality is just such a different world than it is out here. And I would move out here in a heartbeat if I could, but it wouldn't make any sense as far as trying to run a nonprofit that does ocean research or try to sell boats and make money. I mean, the reality is I can't spend the rest of my life sailing around on an Alban Vega or an old rusty Colvin Gazelle. Well, the Colvin Gazelle is not rusty anymore, but I painted it recently. But still, you know, I've got to get a proper blue water boat. And, yeah, proper blue water boats in the, like that, 45 to, you know, 52 foot range. And they're a couple of $100,000, you know, they're 200 grand and that's starting off. And that's if you're lucky, you know, proper stick built, you know, well-designed blue water boats. They're not cheap. So, I mean, how else am I going to get 200 grand? I'm not going to do it doing research. I mean, I could do all the research, you know, I want. It doesn't pay anything. I mean, it might sound great and be nice to, you know, be doing environmental research and trying to help solve some of these problems, working with these scientists, you know, these problems like plastic trash in the ocean and climate-related issues. And, you know, great, but it doesn't pay anything. You know, I don't want to live out of a cardboard box. So I got to do the yacht broker thing. So, you know, so I can save money and buy a better boat, a real boat, a 20-year boat. You know, I need a 20-year boat. I need a freaking flagship, you know. But you need money to do it. And nothing I do really pays anything. There's a Hylas 54 that sunk in St. Martin when that hurricane came by. And, man, I would love to... I've been bouncing around ideas today trying to figure out how I can get my hands on that boat. Obviously, I'd have to bring it back to the surface. It's sunk in like 15, 20 feet of water. So you got to go down, you put these bags on the boat, and then you inflate the bags. And if you can get enough of the bags on it and get enough inflated, you can bring the boat up. The boat must have a hole in it, or else how did it sink? You know, so God knows what's all wrong with it. I mean, everything would have to get stripped out of it. But a Hylas 54 is a nice boat, and you know that's like a $500,000-$600,000 boat all day long. But I'm sure it's just a pipe dream, you know. It's I mean, how would you even do it? You can't even get a plane into St. Martin. The whole airport is destroyed. Like you couldn't fly in there. It'd be really hard to fly in there, and you'd have to bring all your own gear because there's nobody on the island that can do. I mean, everything is trashed. So, yeah, there's a Hylas 54 sitting on the bottom that I may or may not be able to convince an insurance company to part with. But actually getting it and getting it back up to Annapolis and fixing it, God, that would be awesome, though. It would be so awesome to get something like a Hylas 54 that was just beat to death, sunk on the bottom, you know, just all freaking screwed up, and just spend the next, like, 3, 4, 5 years just rebuilding the boat, bit by bit, system by system, and then down the road I'd have like the most incredible 20-year boat, you know. Well, whatever, pipe dreams, I guess. Speaking of hurricanes, Jesus, I mean, that's just some crazy stuff going on between the Virgin Islands and St. Martin and Barbuda. I mean, just getting demolished. And, you know, an episode or two, I was telling a story about that, about my little Katrina thing, but and how I wasn't going to abandon my boat, and I stayed on my boat. You know, I hope I'm not giving people the wrong idea. You know, that was like a Category 1 where we were, because we didn't get the brunt. You know, Katrina was stronger, but we were on the outside of it. So, you know, we only had, like, Cat 1. So that's fine. Like, you know, stay on your boat. Cat 2, okay, stay on your boat. Anything Cat 3, Category 3 or over, I would not stay on your boat. And when it comes to like Category 5, you would have to be completely out of your mind to stay on your boat. Now you guys, I mean, check out, if you haven't seen the pictures yet, I mean, you got to check it out. It's absolutely mass destruction, you know, and the boats piled on boats. And, you know, it's just absolutely horrible. And, you know, it's not just a hurricane. And that's where it's easy to sort of get the wrong thought process going on. So, yeah, okay, the hurricane hits. Let's say Tortola in the Virgin Islands, completely freaking destroyed. The hurricane hit Tortola, right? And then the hurricane's over. Well, when the hurricane's over, that's only the beginning. Because when you have destruction on this level, next thing, there's mass looting, which is what happened. And there's no food and water on the island because, you know, everybody's panicked and grabbed it and looted. And there's no relief, you know, potentially for weeks or months. So, you know, they're really in a really desperate situation right now. You know, it's terrible for them. I actually have something interesting I want to try to read. All right, you guys got to bear with me here. I don't speak very well when I'm just talking, let alone when I'm trying to read out loud. And this thing is a little long, but it's a great firsthand account. A friend of mine, Paul Exner, wrote when he was, he lives in Tortola. He lives there with his wife, and he's got two young kids, 3.5 and 9 months old. And, I mean, there's really nowhere for them to go. They except, you know, their house. And he also has a boat there. And it's, so anyways, let me just read this, do my best here, all right? Heart of goodness and darkness. Liz, Aaron, and Ava are all in good spirits after Irma. We were in the eye for 52 minutes, which means we got a direct hit. Too dangerous to assess the wind speeds accurately, but I believe we had winds over 200 knots. Which, yeah, I believe them too. 200 knots? I mean, Jesus Christ. We were fine until the balcony doors blew in and all hell broke loose. We holed up in a spare bathroom, which was well suited for pre-eye wind directions. The windows opened and closed by themselves with violent fury, and glass was breaking all around us, flying around the house at hurricane wind speed for 2 hours before the eye. I saw my sunfish and dinghy fly past the window at 100-plus knots. That really made me laugh when I read that part the first time. I could just imagine, like, a dinghy flying by, like, at a, you know, like your dinghy flying by at 100 knots. Like, you're sitting in your house and your dinghy just flies by. I don't know. During the reprieve of the eye, we were able to secure the spare bedroom for the 180-degree change in wind direction. 52 minutes was ample time, so much time that it seemed the fury to be over. But I knew better. I had to lash the window to keep it from opening and closing with extreme violence, which would be worse with the change of wind direction after the eye. Secured it with old dock line in my war kit we brought around the house during the maneuvers to keep safe. With an old dock line, I rigged the window under pressure of the extreme consequences. It held. We also had to dismantle, rebuild, and set a suitable locking mechanism for the outside door in the spare bedroom during the calm of the eye. Phillips screwdriver and body pressure got the door secure. I could hear the full fury of the wind approaching on the backside of the eye. Breeze on, full blast of zero to hundreds of knots of wind after the eye. And that's the way it would go. I mean, basically, you go in the eye of a hurricane, you know, you don't have any wind, and then when the other wall gets you, it's like instantly you're back in a hurricane. It happens in seconds. Hold up in the corner of the room behind the baby changing table as glass and rock flew into the glass, eventually breaking pane by pane. We sang Christmas songs and ate peanut butter sandwiches with Aaron, 3.5 years old, and Ava, 9 months. My wife, Liz, is an amazing person. Too much great things to say about Liz, but she is the love of my life. I do not know the status of Solus, which is his sailboat. Tortola is an apocalyptic wasteland, the island totally out of food from looting. British Navy and troops ready to come ashore if necessary. The prison gates blew open during the storm, and the guarded by people with M16s until they were let go. The prison got destroyed on Tortola, and that's like the main prison for the British Virgin Islands, and all the prisoners walked away. So all the prisoners got out of jail and are now walking around with everybody else. Curfew is at 6 p.m. I'm standing in the parking lot of Hotel Trinidad Club using a mobile connectivity box rigged up to a car's 12-volt system. Very ingenious people living here. Total devastation all around. No infrastructure at all. Island will need food and water soon. We can live in our house for another 2 weeks as a family. We are gathering spare plywood and materials to rebuild. No power to house. Hand tools only. Neighbors from all around the Caribbean have bonded on our hillside, Joshua's Bay Valley. Tomorrow we will deal with Hurricane Jose, 90 miles to our north. Paul Exner, Tortola. He wrote this 2 days ago, on the 8th. Yeah, can you imagine that? That's like something out of a Hollywood movie, isn't it? Like, I try to imagine, like, 200 knot winds, and you're in the house in the Virgin Islands, and like glass is flying around, and dinghies are flying by, and doors and windows are like slamming open, slamming closed. You know, and just the sound must have been incredible. The sound of the wind. I mean, it must have been like 1,000 freight trains, you know. I mean, it must have been just unbelievable. I mean, the whole thing is unbelievable. 200 knot winds. I mean, it's just been destroyed. I mean, that whole area. So, yeah, like I was saying in the other podcast, I mean, how do you survive a Category 5 on a sailboat in the ocean? You don't. I mean, I think, you know, it'd be incredibly this incredibly slim chance of surviving. But, you know, even on land, you know, it's, you know, when that kind of wind speed, I mean, it's just nothing you can do but hide and hope that you make it through. So, yeah, man, my heart goes out to all those people in the Caribbean. I've sailed a lot of boats down to the Virgin Islands. And, I look at those pictures and they look really different than the picture in my mind from the last time I was in one of those locations. I mean, it's just, I lived in the Caribbean for 6 months in the Virgin Islands, you know. I mean, I used to live around there. It's just amazing. So anyways, yeah, my condolences and, you know, I hope they rebuild, you know. I hope all the islands, St. Martin and I hope Florida right now is getting hit as I talk. Florida is getting smashed. So hopefully not too many people will get hurt. But anyways, got to cut to commercial.
Bonnie Las Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Las is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Las Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielascharters.com.
This is Carolyn Sherlock from the Boat Galley. If you're going to the Annapolis Sailboat Show, October 5th to 9th, 2017, be sure to stop by and see me in booth M5. On the show map, it'll be listed as Lynn Pardee's booth, and yep, she'll be there too, as well as several others. It's going to be a great time. I can't wait to meet everybody.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford. I am now back in Annapolis, Maryland. I left Washington State a couple days ago, and yeah, it's been a few days. Sometimes I break these podcasts up over a few days. But so yeah, back in Annapolis, and Hurricane Irma has now made it through Florida and Georgia. Actually, I know somebody who lives in Georgia, and a tree in their backyard fell in the storm and punched a big hole in their roof. I'm sure lots of people have had trees fall down on different, you know, cars and houses and garages. But, you know, all in all, although there was definitely damage in Florida, I really thought that Irma was going to be worse than it was. And I'm not saying that to try to downplay what people have been through. I really thought that. You know, what happened is it hit Cuba for a while, and Cuba really, it made landfall in Cuba at Category 5, and it left Cuba Category 3. And so Cuba really took a lot of punch out of it, and even though it rebuilt a little bit after that, had it never hit Cuba, had it stayed north of Cuba, had the eye stayed north of Cuba, it would have been a lot worse when it hit Florida. And if you noticed, when the eye hit the middle Florida Keys, it actually kind of fell apart. Let's get another installment of Paul Exner in Tortola. I read something for you guys in this last segment. It's now been a week since the hurricane. So Paul has written again. I've got to read this out loud, so bear with me, all right? We've been living in our blown-out house in the semi-rural community of Josias Bay since Irma. No running water, no power grid, island-wide.
Only a 12-volt car battery runs a simple water pump to transfer water from our cistern to our gallon jugs for cleaning and toilet flushing. Our master bedroom is gone. Beds in the living room with connecting balcony door secured with plywood has become canvas for a colored chalk drawings by, I call him Ian. His name isn't Ian. It's like Ian. I don't even know how to pronounce this name. It's E-O-I-N. Ian? Owen? I don't know. Anyways, I'm just going to call him Ian right now because I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's the 3.5-year-old kid. I'm writing you from the driver's seat of my car, typing on my laptop, powered by a small inverter connected to the car battery using a mobile router. I retrieved the inverter from Solstice, which was his boat, so he had to go on his boat and rip the inverter out of it. We function between insomnia, sleep deprivation, and adrenaline. Ian laid awake last night for over an hour, saying nothing. I wonder what he's consciously thinking and processing. Food stores were good, but Iva, the 10-month-old, and I stood at a grocery store for 3 hours, purchasing $600 worth of goods. I got $160 worth of baby formula, so the baby won't go hungry. His wife and Liz and Ian hunkered down in the emergency room at Pebbles Hospital because Ian, or Ian, whatever his name is, stuck a peanut up his nose of all the things we needed. So his son had to go to the hospital for a peanut up the nose. I guess there's 200 mostly panicked people staggering around the clinic at the ER. And they had wide ranges of injuries, from blindness, from flying glass, nails and feet, bee stings, high blood pressure, delirium, broken bones from falling or flying with the wind in the case of one person, and one gunshot wound in a burglar's head. So there's just, the ER is just a madhouse. The insect population has exploded, and they're pissed off, swarming the humans aggressively. We are all equals upon this planet Earth. Millions of crickets have appeared. They are everywhere. Rare varieties never seen before, ranging in size and color spectrum. We saw a bright orange and barely identifiable as a cricket. It looked dangerous to my family in our house. I killed it. Bees and Jack Spaniel wasps swarmed us and continually land upon our body. They are too numerous, and I've never experienced this many of them, and they're aggressive. So basically, all these insects lived in the jungle. You know, I mean, it's really the British Virgin Islands. They're really mountainous, jungle-like islands, and all the plants are gone. Their home is gone. The jungle is gone. It's been completely stripped. So I'm guessing that all these insects that usually live hidden away are now just everywhere because they have nowhere else to go. So they're hanging out with the people. At night after the storm, when our house was still war-torn dwelling, a displaced rat came scrambling in. Our island dog Luna hunted and killed as she has done many times in the past. While the afterbands of Irma rattled through our valley during the night, Luna and I combed the house and near outdoors with a flashlight in awe of the destruction, aware of looters and escaped prisoners and other displaced beings dodged around the 6 p.m. military curfew. Insomnia. We spoke directly to a British commando captain as he gave us a private briefing on the situation after Ian's peanut was removed from his nose. This is what the captain, Captain Jim, said. Prisoners escaped when the fence blew down during Irma. They were not let go. Of all the inmates, only 10 are on the list of extremely dangerous, and 5 have been recaptured. The other 5 are profiled well and will be apprehended soon. 30 commandos were sent to Joost Van Dyke to normalize weapons situation there, as some residents of the island have been using their guns for Lord knows what. The looters were rounded up and marched through Road Town in broad daylight as the commandos roughed them up. It seems to be working as looting has dropped way off. The desalination plant and one power plant nearby are operational again. 300 British engineers will be arriving soon, outside civilian contractors, to rebuild the power grid and infrastructure. His boat, Solstice, suffered damage in her bow pulpit, stanchions, lifelines, and a monitor wind vane is trashed. Other than that, she is one of 3% of boats to survive the destruction in Nanny Key Boatyard. I saw a picture of Nanny Key Boatyard from a satellite, and all the boats had been knocked over except his boat. It was like the only boat that didn't get knocked over. The salt ponds in Josiah's Bay and the flats below me, as I type, my wonderful and amazing wife Liz reports there's 12 pink flamingos. My family has devoted all of its energy and strength to working together towards the future. This is only my second public post. The U.S. Embassy worked remotely at the Timurad Club across the valley from us yesterday. I was summoned down by our friend who yelled Paul across the valley. The embassy offered to evacuate us to San Juan by private plane. We declined. The British Virgin Islands are our home. He's been in the Virgin Islands for some time. So yeah, it sounds like they're trying, but it's going to take a year before this infrastructure is back in place. I don't know how long it's going to take for the plant life to come back again. But yeah, that's the report. And I hear there's armed looters in St. Martin running around, especially in the French part of St. Martin. And that Hylas 54 I was talking about earlier was just one of our listings. That's why I know it's there. I mean, it's a ridiculous idea to think you can actually pull a boat up off the bottom when you got armed looters running around. But anyways, that's that. So let me tell you guys a tale of two boat deliveries. Last episode, I said something about how I wouldn't buy a Hunter or a Bavaria. But there's a reason why. I have sailed both of those boats down to the Caribbean or up from the Caribbean out in the ocean. And so, it's, you know, it's a good 1,300 to 1,500 mile passage. And that's a real sea trial. I mean, you know, the cruising world has these, like, boat of the year. I don't know how you can determine what a boat of the year is with a 20-minute sail in the protected waters of the Severn River, you know, adjacent to the Chesapeake Bay. The only way you can really do a sea trial is to go out in the ocean for days on end, dealing with a variety of different conditions. So anyways, the Bavaria, I brought that up from Puerto Rico, heading to the Annapolis in the Chesapeake Bay. And I remember heading just along the east coast of Puerto Rico, getting up to the northeast corner, and a gust hit, and the boat stuck its nose up into the wind, as boats usually do. And I turned the wheel hard over as much as I could to get the boat back on course. And no matter how hard I turned that wheel, it made no difference whatsoever. Like, I could not, the rudder could not overpower the weather helm. And that's a really bad sign. That's a really bad sign of the design of the boat. A boat, you should be able to battle weather helm with the rudder. And of course, there are situations where you have really strong gusts where the boat is going to stick its nose up into the wind. But this gust wasn't that strong. I mean, I should have been able to overpower the weather helm pretty easily. And on a normal boat, I would have. But this boat has a poorly designed underbody. The rudder is not big enough. It's, you know, it needs to have more rudder. And it just grips. It has too much gripping. Gripping is the term for when a boat sticks its nose up into the wind. So there's one thing right off the bat. I'm like, oh crap, you know, this boat really doesn't sail well. And as the trip goes on, whatever, you know, you reef, you unreef, and everything was going okay. And we were on the eastern side of the Gulf Stream, I don't know, maybe 150, 200 miles or so southeast of Cape Hatteras. And we were going to get into the Gulf Stream soon and cross it and make the waypoint. The waypoint you make when coming up from the Caribbean is Diamond Light Shoal Marker, which is off of Hatteras. And that's where you head towards. So I knew we were getting close to the Gulf Stream. We didn't have any weather forecasts. I was told there was a life raft on this boat. And when I opened the valise bag for the life raft, it was full of scuba gear, which really pissed me off. It was like, you tell me there's a life raft on this boat and it's just a bag full of scuba gear? Like, is this some kind of effing joke? No weather forecast. We have no idea what's coming at this point because it had been days since we left. I had some bad feeling, and this is really the only time I've had proper, like, sixth sense or whatever. But something didn't seem right. Something didn't feel right. I saw mare's tails up in the clouds. It just didn't seem right. So I decided to heave to and just wait. I had no good reason to do this. The wind was only blowing 15 knots. But within 6 hours, it was blowing 40 knots out of the northeast. Had we have pushed on, we would have been hit by a nor'easter. This was a late season nor'easter in April. And we would have been hit by this nor'easter right while in the middle of the Gulf Stream out of the worst possible direction. It would have been really, really bad. And so we hove to, and we spent, you know, the next 20 hours or so hove to. The boat didn't heave too well at all. I mean, it was an absolute joke trying to heave to on this boat. And windows, mirrors were popping off the walls. The doors were getting stuck. Some things were I couldn't close. Other things I couldn't open because the hull was twisting with the waves. You couldn't pump all the water out of the bilge. So it was like a puddle was forming in the corner of the boat on the low side. You know, on the low side of the boat, it was coming up over the floorboard and making a puddle. You couldn't get it out. It was just a horrible design boat. I mean, she looked plush when you're sitting in her in a marina, but, I mean, it was probably one of the most god-awful boats I've ever sailed. Now, I took a Hunter down from Annapolis to Puerto Rico, you know, offshore, and the Hunter has made some good boats. The Cherubini, the Hunter Cherubini, I think there's a 36-foot and a 30-foot Hunter Cherubini. Those are pretty damn good boats, and probably some of the best boats that Hunter ever made, because Cherubini is a really quality boat. So it's not every single one is going to be bad. I mean, and there's probably some Bavarias that are decent too. I don't know. This 42-foot Bavaria out there that are okay. But anyways, the Hunters, the biggest problem with the Hunters and the ones I have the problem with are the ones that don't have a backstay. When you don't have a backstay, you have these really far back swept spreaders, you know, big angles. And the problem is you can't let your boom... Wait, let's say the wind is behind you and you're in the ocean. You can't let your boom far enough out to be appropriately trimmed. And so if you do let your boom out, those spreaders poke right into the mainsail because they're so far swept back. And they can rub if you're out in the ocean doing 1,500 miles, they can rub and rub and end up rubbing a hole right through that sail. So right off the bat, you can't even sail appropriately downwind. What happens is because you can't let the boom out far enough, with every little gust, you end up rounding up into the wind because you're not trimmed appropriately. So basically, if you get a boat without a backstay, it just doesn't sail right. So yeah, they just, you know, neither a Hunter or a Bavaria, they just don't sail very well out in the ocean. I mean, they're perfectly fine if you just want to go day sailing around the Chesapeake Bay or island hopping. But if you're going to do that, you might as well get a Jeannot or a Beneteau or a Dufour, because those boats, they sail much better. They're better built. And, I talked bad about the Beneteau Sense. That's only because I took a Beneteau Sense from Annapolis down to Tortola. Actually, it was in a hurricane hole is where I dropped it off. If you look at hurricane hole now, it's one of the famous before and after pictures where you see all these boats in one picture, then it's they're all piled on top of each other the next picture. One of those boats was the Beneteau I took down. I don't just arbitrarily pick out boats to talk bad about. It's not something I read or something I overheard. I mean, I've experienced these boats in the ocean. And they're a bit, you know, they're just not made for it. They're not making production. Plastic Fantastic boats are just built as glorified day sailors and as island hoppers. And they're perfectly fine. A Beneteau Sense is perfectly fine for going around the Chesapeake Bay or bouncing around the Caribbean. It's a great boat for that purpose. They're just not really good out in the ocean. All right, I gotta go.
I'm John Herlig. In Postcards from Sea, I tell stories of my travels aboard Ave Del Mar, my 1967 Rawson cutter. I deal with serious nautical issues like how to sail your mast into a tree on a canal, what kind of incense best covers the aroma of kimchi fermenting on your boat, or whether or not I can beat a leukemia patient at a video game. It's simply the story of my life, and my life happens to take place on a 50-year-old sailboat with no particular destination in mind. I hope you'll join me and some of the wonderful characters I meet as I travel for my show, Postcards from Sea, every other Monday here on Boat Radio. Time goes forward.
Go and catch your jet. You will find your moment. Time goes forward. Stay and have a sniff. Let's dream about the future.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children, so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
This is Bob Bitchin from Cruising Outpost Magazine, and I love listening to Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting on my boat back in Annapolis, Maryland. I do want to say, before I get into story time here, I want to say one thing about Hurricane Irma and climate change. Scientifically, you can't prove anything with just one data point. You need hundreds of data points. You need thousands of data points. When it comes to climate change, it's all about long-term trends. It's not about, you know, if you got like a particularly warm winter or a cold summer, you can't be like, oh, this is proof that climate change is happening, or oh, this is proof that climate change isn't happening. It doesn't work that way. And it's really easy to think about this from an emotional standpoint, especially when you got a massive hurricane killing people, destroying all sorts of stuff. It's very easy to get emotional and look at it from that stance. But you got to be like Spock on Star Trek. You got to look at it from a logical point of view, not an emotional point of view. So like, you got to look at long-term trends. So let's say the Arctic. If you look at the last 40 years of ice in the Arctic, if you look at a graph, you will see that there's been a general decline in the amount of ice in the Arctic over the last 40 years. Now, every year isn't going to be less. Some years, the Northwest Passage, for instance, has more ice. Other years, it has less ice. Just because you got one year with more ice or less ice doesn't change, isn't enough to scientifically prove or disprove anything. One hurricane is not enough to scientifically prove or disprove anything. You have to look at trends. You have to look at the big picture, take a step back and look at it from like 25 years, 30 years, 40 years. That's what you got to do. It's all climate change. Proving the existence of man-made climate change is all about looking at the long-term trends. So I do personally think that that climate change could certainly make stronger hurricanes. There's no doubt about that, but in my mind, at least. But like I said, I gotta be logical, like freaking Spock, and I gotta you know, look at the long term and not just the short term. So, back to the story. This is the story of when I sailed from Annapolis to Europe, Africa, the Caribbean, and back single-handed on a 323 Pearson. This is the precursor to my trip around the Americas and ultimately the foundation of Ocean Research Project, or the creation of Ocean Research Project, I guess I should say. But anyway, so I'm in Africa. I'm in Senegal, West Africa, in Dakar. Just checked in with immigration and back on the boat. So the reason I sailed to West Africa in particular is because of the kora. The kora is a stringed instrument that comes out of Africa. Originally, it's like a big gourd, sort of like the size of a, Maybe the size of a guitar, but it looks nothing like it. The body is a big gourd. It's covered with a skin, and then it has this neck coming out of it, I don't know, 3 feet in the air with all these strings attached to it. I'm doing a horrible job of describing a kora. It's K-O-R-A. Just Google it. You'll see what I'm talking about. But anyways, in the 1970s, my dad went to Mali in West Africa to learn to play the kora. And it's a West African instrument. You only really find it in Mali, Senegal, and Gambia for the most part. So he was there in the early 70s, and he got malaria and dysentery simultaneously and almost died. And so he had to leave, and he had to leave early before he had, you know, finished his practice or whatever. And so I wanted to sail back to West Africa and find a kora maker and have somebody make one of these instruments for my dad. So I show up in that car, and the next thing is to try to find a kora maker. Now, the kora was originally a four-stringed instrument that was a battle instrument during the time of the Malayan Empire. There was the big empire of Mali at one point a long time ago. And when they would go into battle, they would play this instrument, bunga, gabanga, gabanga, you know, it's like to get the troops in sync, and that was like this war instrument. So the Empire of Mali fought on the same side as the Moors when the Moors invaded the Iberian Peninsula. The Iberian Peninsula is Spain and Portugal today. So the Muslim Moors, with the Malayan army and other armies, the army of Mali, they invaded the country. They took basically the whole peninsula. They held it for hundreds of years before the Spanish eventually kicked them out. And while they were there, the four-stringed instrument combined with a European harp. So by the time they left, it now had 32 strings instead of four strings. So I was in, I found, and basically only two families play the kora. The Jabates and the Kunates. And these are families that have been playing the kora since the very beginning. So if you ever meet a Jabate, they're going to be really good at playing the kora. They pass it down generation to generation. Tumane Jabate is the best kora player in the world right now. So I find these guys, Racine Jabate and his family, and they build koras. Racine was in his early 20s, he was a hell of a kora player. So I ended up spending like 5 days with this guy, and he would play little gigs all over Dakar. And I'd meet him in the morning, and we'd get something called Cafe Tuba. Cafe Tuba is like this coffee, this spiced coffee stuff. And we drink Cafe Tuba. He smoked crazy amounts of ganja. He's always rolling up a doobie. And so we would, we would get our morning recreation, and then we would jump in his little beat-up car and drive around town to all these different gigs, and he would go into some restaurant and play for an hour or 2 hours, and then we'd, then he'd drink more Cafe Tuba and roll more doobies, and then drive somewhere else and play the kora, and it sort of went on like this all day. He was an amazing kora player. In West Africa, in Dakar, sometimes the power cuts off. Just completely out of nowhere. It's like, it's nighttime, the power cuts off, and it just gets pitch black. Like, absolutely pitch black. And he wouldn't miss a beat. He'd be in the middle of a song, and the power would cut off, and he would not miss one note. It was as if nothing ever happened. Then the power would cut back on a minute or two later, and it was amazing. I guess he's just been doing it a long time. But anyways, it took about 5 days or so to get this kora together. The CBD Yacht Club, it wasn't much of a yacht club. And like I said, it was mostly French. And I did hang out there a little bit, one or two nights. I hung out with some French people, played some French game where you throw a ball at other balls. I don't know what the hell it was called. You try to knock your ball with other balls. I sort of got tired of that. And I wasn't really going there to hang out with Europeans that much anyways. I mean, not primarily. I wanted to see Africa. So on this beach that separated, the anchorage from the yacht club, a lot of locals would hang out there. So I just started hanging out with the locals at night. And they were all poor. There's about six or eight of them, of African dudes, that would meet every evening on this part of the beach. And they would scrape together whatever food they had, whatever money and food. And it was typically flying fish. That's what we usually ate. And they would throw a bunch of newspaper down. They'd make a little fire on the beach, and we would cook the flying fish. And then they would throw all the food that we had on this on a newspaper on the beach, and everybody would just sort of go at it. You know, everybody, it was all big communal. Everybody was sharing. I would bring some, I'd get some higher end fish. Sometimes I got swordfish. I also got gin. They had a really crappy gin that these guys liked, so I'd walk down, and for like $2, I could get some gin and come back and, you know, throw that in the mix. And, yeah, it was really nice. It was really nice. You know, I mean, these guys were way more broke than I was. I mean, I had a boat. They didn't have a boat. You know, they barely had shoes on their feet. But they were willing to share this food with me, you know, that when they didn't have hardly anything. And so, that, you know, it was just, it was really nice. You know, that car is nice for the most part. The problem is it's really hard to walk around like the there's something called Independence Square, which is sort of like the downtown area of Dakar. And being white, it's really hard to walk around there because you can't take more than one or two steps without someone saying, Mr. Mister, do you want to buy this? Or Mr. Mister, do you want to buy that? And it gets to the point where you have two and three and four and five people surrounding you trying to get you to buy something constantly. And it's like you can't get 2 seconds away from people that are just, you feel like you're being mobbed to buy stuff. I've heard of people having even worse incidences of this in like India, where they've had like groups of like 30 and 40 people surrounding them all trying to get them to buy something. But it's really overwhelming, even when you only got five or six people. You know, it's like you finally get rid of one of them and two more show up. And so walking around that section was kind of difficult. But, you know, for the most part, I really enjoyed Dakar, and I spent a lot of time hanging out with those guys on the beach. I spent a lot of time with Racine Jabate, driving around, drinking Cafe Tuba, and going to different gigs. And after, you know, a couple of weeks of being there, they had built this Cora for my dad, and you know, I basically had gotten what I came for. While I was there, I met this guy, Yanni, and Yanni and Bruno. So Yanni was a German guy who was riding a bicycle alone from Berlin to South Africa. He was trying to get to South Africa in time for the World Cup. That year, the World Cup was in South Africa. It's a hell of a thing to try to do, biking alone, you know, on a bicycle through Africa, north to south. I mean, you got to go through the desert. You got to bike through the Sahara Desert. You got to go through the jungles of like the Congo. I mean, it's a crazy thing. And, you know, of course, I appreciated it because I rode a bicycle alone through Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand, spent 100 days biking through villages and mud huts and big cities and everything you can imagine. And so, you know, I was sympathetic to the cause. But when I met him, he had just gone through the Sahara Desert. And he said he lost like 8 stone or something. I think a stone, that couldn't have been right, 8 stone. A stone is like 8 pounds or something. It's an English measurement. Anyway, he lost at least 30 pounds going through the biking through the Sahara Desert. So he needed some time to recuperate. So he was at the CVD Yacht Club. There was also, he was sleeping in a tent, like, next to the beach. And he was walking around barefoot quite a bit, which is going to come back to haunt him in the next interval of this story. So I asked Yanni, you know, I've been alone. I've been single-handed for a long time at this point. And I had Whitney with me for a little while earlier, that snowboarder girl. But that was a long time ago. And so I said, hey Yanni, man, you want to take a break from this biking and come with me up the Gambia River? And, you know, he said, let me think about it. And so he thought about it. He said, okay, sure. You know, that, sounds good. I wouldn't mind doing it. Gambia is only like 80 miles south of Dakar. I think it was some 80, 90, 100 miles. I don't remember. I've done so many passages, I don't remember every single length of every single one, but it wasn't very far. Maybe it's 120, but it's not very far to get from Dakar to the Gambia River. And so I also noticed he was hanging out with this guy, Bruno. Bruno was an Italian. He was French. He lived in southern France, but he had an Italian name. He lived over by Marseille or something. And he had fake dreadlocks, which was, I don't know, whatever. But he was a young kid, and he was just, he was like the opposite of Yanni. But, you know, he was trying to get a boat and try to go somewhere. And I saw him and Yanni hanging out on several occasions. So I just figured that him and Yanni were cool and were friends or something. So Bruno asked me, like, a day before I was going to leave with Yanni, like, hey, can I come with you down to Gambia? And I said, okay, sure, you know, whatever. Thinking that it would be all good. I'm setting up a lot for the next story because the next story is kind of crazy here. But it's a, you know, when we get to Gambia, I might have to do a longer segment about that next time. I don't know. But yeah, so I leave Dakar with this Cora and with this guy Yanni and his bicycle. I stuck his bicycle, tied it off up by the shrouds, and Bruno. It was about, like I said, I think it was, I don't know, 90 to 120 mile passage. It wasn't terribly long. And Yanni, the German guy, the biker, he was loving it. He was good help. Bruno, the French kid, was seasick and curled up in a ball and was basically useless. And that's more or less the trend that's going to continue here in this story between those two. So, yeah, we arrive in Gambia. And I'll start off there next time. In the meantime, you can check out the website. It should be fixed in another... We're getting a new website in another couple of months. OceanResearchProject.org. You can make a donation via PayPal on the website. There's videos from last year's expedition. Also, I work with David Walters Yacht Sales. If you are looking to buy a boat or looking to sell your boat, shoot me an email at matt@davidwaltersyachts.com. Or matt@roguewaveyachtsales.com. They all go to the same place. And yeah, I'll be happy to work with you and try to find you the best boat for your budget, considering whatever it is you're trying to do and however many people you're trying to do it with. So yeah, guys, I hope you have a good week. Hopefully Hurricane Jose does not swing around and hit the United States, because right now one of the forecasts, at least, is that we might get Jose hitting somewhere in North Carolina or Virginia. Who knows what's going to happen? You know, it's hard to predict hurricanes. But, I hope everybody's doing okay. You know, shout out to everybody in Florida and Caribbean who's been hurt by Irma. And, you know, I hope everything gets rebuilt quickly. I hope everybody, you know, it's always tough with these sort of situations, you know. So I just wish you guys the best. All right.
When you're ready to escape, but your boat's not ship-shape, that's okay, skipper's review will get you on your way. Marina's mechanics, satellites, and crew, skippersreview.com will fight it for you. Friends will tell you which ones to use in just a few words with their glowing reviews. Skippersreview.com, where boaters know best and businesses pass the test.
A quick reminder, I'll be at the Annapolis Sailboat Show in booth M5 with Lynn Party and others. Stop by. I want to meet you.
With a plan to expand my vision, yeah, it's either this or it's prison. I'm trying to be free and expand my wisdom. I gotta tell my story. I did it for the journey, the glory. Many men tried way before me. I had to do it bigger cause I had to make history. From the streets to the sea, far away, not a soul did I see. From Chesapeake up to Baffin Bay, my motto is hard work first and laugh and play. Now let's take a trip through the Northwest Passage. Some say I got a problem, I say it's a passion. I'm just trying to reach my goals before passing, and I'ma do what I wanna do without asking. It's my life, my right, so I fight for my dreams, no matter how hard it might seem. This is my pipe dream. My advice to get your mind right, find light and do the right thing, no matter the weather or whatever the night brings. Thunder and lightning, it's enlightening. Lost in the abyss, I can't even begin to explain how awesome this is. I've been all around the world and back around the world to find myself, to reach my goals, to find my dreams. When I'm away, to wash away, I explore. I've been all around the world and back around the world to find myself, to reach my goals, to find my
of dreams when I'm away to wash away. I explore. I've been all around the world and back, all around the world and back, all around the world and back. I've been all around the world and back, world and back, world and back. I've been all around the world and back, all around the world and back, all around the world and back. I've been all around the world and back, world and back, world and back. For gold, it was a mission to get rich. I do it for soul. They thought that I was a misfit, it would probably fall. But I'm the type to go the distance and finish the brawl. They said that it was suicide, that I would die for sure. But I was like the prince of tide in the eye of a storm. Yo, to great waves, they send sailors crashing. You're on the map, I'm on the face of the atlas. Thousands of miles away, I'm trying to see the world while you sit at home, probably doing the same thing. The fact that you don't want to get out and explore is a damn shame. It's either you're too lazy to do it or you just can't hang. Trendsetter, major sailor, the vendetta, breaking the world record, no one can do it better. There's so much in the world you must see, and you can make a big difference, just you and me. I've been all around the world and back, around the world,